and I grab, you know, my first t-shirt or whatever, and I jam it along this thing. My hand slips and I smash my knuckles to it and I cut my knuckles open. I bleed all over my teacher. It's a total catastrophe.
It's much harder to get blood out, too.
Yes, yes.
Welcome to Everyday Abundance, the podcast that explores the hidden histories behind everyday activities and technologies you didn't even know were technologies. Hi, I'm Virginia Postrell.
I'm Charles C. Mann.
In this episode, we're going to discuss what may be the best technology ever. Certainly the best technology in the last couple hundred years. The most liberating, anyway, technology in the last couple hundred years.
One that freed humankind from toil.
Freed half of humankind from toil.
She said bitterly.
Oh, it's not my problem. It's my ancestors. We are talking, of course, about the electric washing machine.
Yay!
Nowadays, doing laundry is my favorite household chore because it is so easy. You just put the clothes in the washing machine, you put the detergent in, and you go away and do something else. Could be work, could be TV, whatever. It's not laundry. The machine does the work for you. This was not always the case.
Yes. I got a chance to see for myself what it used to be like in the early 1980s when I went for the first time to India. At the time, India was much, much poorer than it is today. But still, even I, a completely oblivious idiot, was able to tell that this was an interesting, fascinating place, that lots of stuff was going on. It's also a hot and dusty place.
That part is still true.
And I was running around Mumbai, which was then called Bombay. I rapidly got all my clothes sweaty and dirty. I went to my hotel. There's a little bag you could put your laundry in. I brought it down to the front desk, and they tossed my bag onto an enormous pile of similar bags, and I began to get anxious. It did not have sort of sense of a well-oiled machinery that I, at least, was used to. So I was therefore doing an article. I was traveling with a friend of mine who's a photographer, another friend who is a journalist. We all got curious to what was going to happen to our clothes. We got a taxi, asked them to take us to what we assumed would be a modern laundromat. It was not. We ended up on the waterfront in front of a pile of clothes about two stories tall.
Oh, my God.
And it was surrounded by women. I mean, scores. I have just no idea how many, but many who were sewing little loops of thread into each garment, like every piece of underwear, every t-shirt, to distinguish them from every other garment, according to what was obviously an elaborate code that required enormous intelligence to understand and even devise.
So this would be this underwear is Charles C. Mann's underwear. This shirt is Charles C. Mann's shirt.
Right.
Something but about these threads
right.
would say that.
And then they would toss them on this. Then they would be carried over to the waterfront where there is this area that is, and there were another enormous mass of women wanging these clothes on flat rocks and just beating the living tar out of them and working really hard in this water that had a little bit of soap in it. And then there was a second group of women who were wanging them and cleaning them in fresh water. It was enormously hot and dusty, as I mentioned before, and this was really hard work. Now, I'm sure these women had camaraderie and so forth in ways of making it taller, but this was obviously just ceaseless toil that went on 24/7. And this was the way laundry was done throughout the world for millennia.
And at least those women were getting paid.
I hope, yeah.
Maybe not much, but they were getting paid something.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was a tiny window into the past. Now, how important is washing clothes? Let me tell you a sort of a roundabout way of giving you the idea of how important this task is in human history by asking already another question. When did people start wearing clothes? Now, this turns out to be a surprisingly difficult question to answer. And the reason is that clothes are made of fabric, and fabric doesn't last that long for archaeologists.
Right. Yes, someone wrote a book about it.
Right. You know, people are not digging up 500,000-year-old shirts. You know, it disappears. So how can we do this? From genetic evidence and a little bit of physical anthropology, that our ancestors started losing their body hair about 1.2 million years ago. So we presume that that made them more vulnerable to extremes of cold and temperature right. and rain and so forth. And so they start maybe throwing on hides or something.
Right. And plus there's this thing called the Ice Age. There's actually more than one of them.
Right. So 1.2 million years ago, probably the beginning. But when are they actually starting to wear clothes? The first physical evidence we have of clothes aren't the clothes themselves again, but needles with eyes in them.
Right.
Because there are needles before, but they could be awls. They could be these needles with eyes in them are for sewing,
right?
Of some sort, and fairly complex.
Right.
Sewing.
And people ask me this question all the time, because even though I didn't write a book about clothes, I wrote a book about textiles. There's an Australian scholar called Ian Gilligan who writes about when do people start wearing clothes. And he talks about this development of what he calls complex clothing,
yes.
which is clothing that fits around your body, where you need a needle and
right.
possibly ways of cutting it. That is, it's warmer than just wrapping a hide around yourself.
Right.
And when in these ice ages, people have little body hair, complex clothing seems to develop in this period.
Right. So, but that's a pretty big gap.
Yes.
40,000 years, 1.2 million years ago. Geneticists, actually biologists based in Florida, come up with a very clever idea for dating when the emergence of real clothing begins. And what they do is they look at lice. Almost as soon as you get clothing, you get lice. Basically, there's two types of lice. One is crabs, and they're a completely different genus and so forth. We're going to ignore them.
Sometimes called pubic lice.
Pubic lice.
Yes,
right.
They're
right.
crabs.
They're crabs.
Completely unrelated. Yeah, right. That's not.
And
we're
going
we're
to ignore
about.
Them except to mention this is. The kind of lice we're talking about is the body louse or the head louse. As far as we know, our great ancestors had lice in the way that primates have lice. But when you lose your hair, they retreat with the hair, and so you get head lice,
okay.
which people have. And those are the ones that that species, Pediculus humanus, is what you get when you, an upper middle class person, go take your kid to the daycare and discover, oh, no, and you have to comb them out. And there's been this, you know, mass discovery that these terrible things happen. People put on clothes and that provides warmth for the lice, and you get the body louse, which is a subspecies of Pediculus humanus, and is actually distinguishable by appearance and behavior and so forth.
Genetics.
So we can distinguish them genetically. And there are methods that geneticists have developed to tell when two organisms have diverged genetically.
Right, right. And so it starts out, it's just what we would now call the head louse.
Right.
And then at some point,
it splits off and becomes this new
subspecies.
And that point is about 170,000 years ago, more or less. Big emphasis on more or less, because it's not an exact science, nearly as exact as we would wish. But the point about this is getting rid of vermin in your clothes is one of the most important parts of washing your clothes. So dirtiness of clothes and washing clothes is so fundamental that we actually use it to date the appearance of clothing itself.
Right, right. So vermin is a major reason. Nowadays, rarely, at least in modern day America, are thinking about vermin. We're thinking more like, oh, I got a stain, or it smells
right.
like sweat. But this is
getting
the
rid of bugs.
Is a very
big deal. And in fact, we know from our anthropological reports and historical reports that indigenous people, when they're wearing robes and so forth, they're wanging them
right.
to get rid of the bugs.
So this brings up the second point, which is, how do you clean your clothes? And there are two basic mechanisms or two basic techniques, both of which are represented in the electric washing machine. The first is the one you alluded to with the Lakota.
Specific.
They used to hang up their buffalo robes in the sun and whack them so that the dirt came out. And this is mechanical.
And we still do this today a little bit in that I have these little throw rugs that are
right.
in my kitchen, and they get dirty, and I periodically pick them up and I go outside and I flap them and shake off the dirt.
Right. Yes. And beading rugs is
yes.
a major example of this. It's not clothes, but beading rugs,
yes.
especially in the days before vacuum cleaners,
right.
this was a big way of cleaning that. So that's mechanical. You're pushing the dirt out. The other way is chemical. And that is where soap comes in. What is soap later detergents? It's a chemical. And it's a chemical that historically is made by taking some form of grease off an animal fat, but you could do it with a vegetable oil too, and something alkaline, which is often wood ashes, and sort of cooking them together to form this molecule that we can call soap. And the way the soap molecule looks is it's got a little head on the top, like a dressmaker's pin might have, and a tail, a little shaft. And the head part bonds with water, pulls the water, and the tail part bonds with grease, with bacteria.
Because bacteria have a lipid, right, that they call shell. It's kind of a fatty shell.
The tail bonds with oily things or fatty things. So that could be bacteria. It could also be, you know, you spill dinner on your shirt or something like that. Technically, the moment you put it in water, that's a chemical process, but
only a pedantic person.
Right, exactly. So it's often the case people might actually only use water and then use a lot of this whacking,
right,
like you saw in India and like I saw in India in a slightly different context, which was dyeing,
right,
where you have excess dye and you want to get the excess dye out, put it in water. And this guy who was a master dyer, he would hold the cloth over his head in a bunch and just make these tremendous noises as it hit the pavement.
I actually understand this because when I was in college, I'm embarrassed to say, I was in the era when people were tie-dyeing clothes. And I thought, well, I'll try it. And I did not really understand this part about getting rid of the excess dye. I put on my tie-dyed t-shirt, I sweated, and I dyed myself pink. And it turns out dye is hard to get out.
Yeah, if it's a good dye.
And I had a pink body for...
Right. The point is, two ways to get clothes clean,
right,
or other textiles, mechanical and chemical. And,
right.
And one reason a buffalo robe, for example, would only use mechanical is that you don't really want to get it wet.
We have to say, both of these involve labor.
It's a lot of labor, and there are also often a lot of different steps.
Yes.
In it, it's not just one thing. Luckily, we have a description of how laundry, or one type of laundry, worked that's very, very old. This is old Babylonia period, cuneiform.
And the cuneiform is this kind of writing which you may have seen, where people have tablets of wet clay, and they incise little marks in them to communicate.
Right, right. And the cuneiform tablet is typically about the size of your palm.
Right.
And you use a little stylus. I actually, when I was researching my book, I actually took a little workshop where we made cuneiform.
Yeah.
And the great thing about them is the various cultures that used these kept a lot of records, and the clay lasts.
Right.
And so we have lots and lots of records, in this case, from this ancient Mesopotamian city of Ur, the Ur city, and it's a story it's a dialogue that is called by scholars in English at the cleaners.
Right, inventive name.
Right. One point to note is that this is early specialization. This is a conversation between a customer and somebody whose job it is to clean his, to make his clothes nice.
Right.
And the clothes in this case would be one long sheet wrapped like a toga kind of idea. And there are lots and lots of steps. The first one of which is taking the two short ends of the sheet and sewing them together, basting them together, so that when they're washed, it's less messy.
It doesn't get tangled?
I mean, or at least that's my assumption of that's why they do it. But that's the first step. So you wash part of it, the particularly stained part, in beer. Then you spray it with water, put this kind of clay that's called Fuller's Earth. You rub it on it. So that's like...
So are these multiple chemical...
Chemical processes.
Yeah.
There's several stages of beading with different things. And then there's a polishing and brushing and fluffing.
Wait, fluffing.
Fluffing and felting. Well, this is wool.
Right.
to be honest, I don't know why they really want it to be so felted in ancient Mesopotamia.
So felted is
when the wool fibers sort of mat together.
Yeah.
And they create more of a solid surface. And
right.
So if you want to keep out the wind or you want to keep out the rain, felted wool garments would be good.
Are they preserving the felt or restoring it?
Yeah, they're kind of restoring it. So these are not garments made out of felt, like you go to the craft store and buy some felt. What it is it's a woven wool garment where you wet it and then you apply pressure to it, which is a process that's called fulling, and you apply chemicals to it. This is when you're making it.
Right. Okay. Well, when you're making it. But when I'm cleaning it, I'm doing...
But they're sort of restoring it to its previous state.
Is there like a brush or something?
Yeah, there are brushes.
Wow.
And also he does repairs if there's a tear or whatever. And at the end, he smooths it and folds it. And the idea will be... You know, just like new.
Wow.
But it's this very elaborate process that is hard work.
Yeah.
The first and most important thing to know about laundry is that it's really hard getting clothes clean.
So we have this complex industry in 2800 BC or whenever.
2000 to 1600 BC.
Yeah. So this is one of humankind's most ancient complex industrial processes.
It's a complex. And, I mean, and this is one person, but it's a lot of steps, a lot of chemicals. Illustrating laundry is hard.
Yeah.
You told me you once tried a washboard, which was the classic sort of 19th century farm in America way of washing clothes.
I was in college and I had to deal with a pay laundry.
As did we all.
For the first time in my life. And it required many, many quarters.
Yes. And nowadays, just worth mentioning, one form of progress is you can now use a credit card at a laundromat.
And I would, of course, leave my laundry to the last possible minute. Thursday night, I wouldn't have underwear for Friday or something like this. I would have to do this. The banks would be closed. And I would have to go around and humiliatingly ask my friends for quarters. So I decided to rebel against the tyranny of the laundromat. And I thought, why do I have to keep coming up with these quarters? I can wash my clothes myself. And there was a thrift shop in town, and they had an old washboard. And I thought, I'll do it this way and, you know, just buy a little bit of detergent and save this whole humiliating thing. And I'll have my underwear whenever I want.
So what did the washboard look like?
Oh, a piece of wood that was probably 2 feet long, and it had a bunch of ridges in it, like a corrugated Venetian blind.
Yeah.
So there between the ridges was a little gap for water, and even I could tell what you're supposed to do was rub it along and squudge the soapy water through the little holes in the ridges.
So it's providing the mechanical part of the cleaning, and you're providing the soap.
So I got a bucket of water, I put some laundry in it, swooshed it up, and do this. Now, I have to say that my roommate was less than enthusiastic about this whole thing because I was doing it in our room.
Right. Yeah, this is a whole other thing about laundry is when you get urbanization in the 19th century and people are often living in rooming houses or whatever, they have to send their laundry out to somebody to do it, even if they wanted to do it because everybody, it's like your roommate.
Right. Less objected, but it was so weird from his point of view, or any normal person's point of view, that he didn't object very forcefully because he was so taken aback that his his roommate had temporarily taken leave of his sanity. But I was filled with this idea that I can do this myself.
And this was DIY was very big in this period anyway.
Yes.
But the Whole Earth catalog and
such. Yeah. I don't need the man, to teach me how to.
Right.
So I do this and I grab, my first T-shirt or whatever, and I jam it along this thing. My hand slips and I smash my knuckles to it and I cut my knuckles open. I bleed all over my teacher. It's a total catastrophe.
It's much harder to get blood out, too.
Yes. I immediately make things much, much worse. So, I am here to tell you that I persevered. I bandaged myself and I washed like 3 T-shirts. And I said, this is a bad idea. I'm going to get some quarters.
So one of the first things people do, and to this day in developing countries, when they get any money, is they hire somebody else to do their laundry.
And I'm here to tell you, this is a good idea.
If you don't have access to washing machine, that's a big thing. And in the 1900s sense, the number one job in America was servant. And the number one servant job, sub-job, was washwoman, washerwoman.
Right. So it's this major category of American employment.
Right. One way you could get somebody else to do your laundry is you could have a household staff that included a washerwoman or potentially a servant who is a more maid of all work who does the laundry. And doing the laundry for any reasonably sized household, it doesn't have to be giant, it could be a family of four, it's basically an all-day job. Blue Monday is the day for doing laundry. It involves boiling water on a stove and often boiling the laundry, and there are different steps and different pre-treatments, we'd call them today. And you can, if you look at a laundry manual from this period, just looking at all the steps and all the things you're supposed to put together, assemble in order to do laundry is exhausting, much less doing it. So the other thing that happens in the late 19th century, early 20th century are commercial laundries.
Right. Though, isn't this a little bit like what was going on in ancient Babylonia?
Well, it's more like what you saw in India, actually.
Okay.
In some ways, the ancient Babylonia is almost like a dry cleaner or something like that. It seemed to be a smaller scale, but it's what you saw in India, essentially. Yeah. It is a modern thing because people are using steam-powered boilers. They're large commercial institutions that employ girls and women. And I say girls and women because the youngest people working in one would be like 15. It's not just like a child labor thing.
To me, I'm imagining some place that's pretty odious, that's really hot and hard. And so am I accurate?
Well, we have a general idea of what went on. So one thing was that women who worked in laundries had a kind of bad reputation. And I don't mean like they were harlots. They had this reputation for being sort of nasty and swearing a lot and being kind of mean and
tough customers.
Tough customers. This is a period in the late 18th and early 19th century where there were a number of women journalists.
Okay.
And some of them wrote for the women's pages. Right. And there were even some who were covered foreign policy or whatever. Not much, but mostly they wrote for the women's pages. Or they did what was called stunt journalism, where Nellie Bly for the New York Sun goes undercover in a madhouse and writes about her experiences.
Right.
This is the kind of thing. And there was a woman named Elizabeth L. Banks, who was an American. She starts out in journalism in the U.S. Actually, she starts as a typewriter girl, but she eventually moves into journalism. She works in the U.S., and then she goes to Britain, and she works in London. And one of the things she does is she's very much like you, inquiring journalist. She is living she's living in a kind of boarding house arrangement where her landlady sends out her laundry.
Yeah.
It sends out each tenant's laundry. And Elizabeth Banks starts to wonder, like, where is her laundry going?
Right.
And she asks, and her the first person she asks, which is like the maid who cleans up the place, has no idea. She asks the landlady. The landlady says, oh, it's Mrs. Johnston. And the landlady doesn't even know where Mrs. Johnston lives. And there's this whole thing where she's tracking her down. And
it's not an obvious thing then to
right,
do this.
Right, right. Yeah. She decides that she's going to try to get a job working in a laundry so she can say really what it's like.
Okay.
And she has previously gotten a job like working as a servant in a big house. This is sort of a thing she does. So she puts an ad in the paper that says that she wants to learn the business social work for free. The key part, as she is very conscious, is offering to work for free because she basically has no laundry skills to speak of other than what she's kind of did growing up maybe. So she gets a job in a laundry and under this like learn the business work for free. And she writes about her first day. This is kind of a long quote, but I think it's worth it. She enters the room and she says, an atmosphere thick with steam and the odor of boiling soap suds greeted me. Ironing machine, wringer, and mangle were revolving at a rapid rate, propelled by the large engine. That's the steam engine. And a mangle is a device that you put your laundry through after it's been rinsed, and it sort of simultaneously gets the water out and kind of presses it. There are rollers involved. Water was sputtering from the boilers in which the clothes were being washed. A dozen girls and women were ironing, others were starching, sprinkling, or folding clothes, and a solitary water-soaked individual presided in one corner over some wash tubs, applying a scrubbing brush to clothes that could not be put into the machines. That is, they were probably too delicate.
No.
All the work was done in one immense room, floored over with cement, which was a succession of hills and hollows more dangerous in aspect than any American pavement, by which she means, I assume, a sidewalk. One side of the room was taken up with an ironing machine and ironing tables, the other side with the engines, boilers, wringer, mangle, and wash tubs. A corner in the vicinity of the engine was floored over with some boards and filled up with crude-looking tables and a half dozen large boxes. It was called the sorting room. So the sorting room is where the laundry, as it sounds, is sorted. And her first job is very much like what you observed in India. She is tasked with sewing little numbers into the garments with red thread. And one of the things she remarks is she doesn't think it's a very efficient system. She thinks that Chinese laundries in the U.S. have a better, simpler system. She doesn't completely describe it, but and she's really bad at it. I mean, it's basic embroidery, but she can't keep up the pace. A lot of this is her having the basic skills, but not being able to do things as fast. But fortunately, this young woman named Janie takes her under her wing and helps her with the embroidery for the number. And she spends the day doing that and getting lots of pricked fingers and such. What she really wants to do is ironing. So here they actually, the washing, the scrubbing for the most part is actually done by machines because it's a commercial laundry. And that's one advance. You don't have washing machines in the house yet, but you have them.
Yeah.
But ironing is this huge job. An iron doesn't work the way it works today. It's not an electric thing. Mm. It's you heat it on a stove, then you bring it over, and then when it gets cool,
so
you heat
like
another one.
A fire and there's in a burner for
there's a burner. So I should back up and talk a little bit about the different ways of ironing. In early China, they had basically like a little pan, little metal pan that you'd fill with coals, and it would be hot, and they would rub it over the clothes. And
so that's like a cast iron pan that I fill heat from the
small,
inside.
Small. And actually, the way I know what it looks like is there is a Chinese American History Museum in San Francisco that has one of these that go back to ancient times in China, but were used in Chinese laundries in the U.S. Sometimes you just have the most common thing is just a metal iron, and they have different shapes or different sizes for different things that's heated on a stove or in the fire. But sometimes there are irons that you can put coals directly into to keep it hot while you're ironing so you don't have to keep going back and forth from the stove. So Elizabeth Banks says, I want to do ironing. I used to iron for my family. I know how to iron. Get me to iron. And there's this whole discussion of like, no, the boss is never going to let you iron. You don't know what you're doing.
You haven't swept the dojo for 2 years.
You hardly can handle the sorting and labeling, but she wants to learn the business. So Janie intervenes and convinces the manager or the laundry owner, as she actually is, to let Elizabeth iron. And so she irons and she irons and she irons and she is so exhausted after a day of ironing, and she's burning her hands. And a lot of the exhaustion is actually going back and forth to the stove to get a new iron.
Right.
And she's not very good at it again. And again, it's not that she doesn't know how to iron. It's that she can't do it fast enough. So
right. She's in a kind of factory situation.
Right. This is really a factory. Exactly. So the first thing to have her iron is handkerchiefs.
Mm-hmm.
And because if you've ever ironed handkerchiefs, they're easy to iron. They're flat pieces
of
cloth.
we should say that handkerchiefs are a big deal.
Yes. Another episode on blowing your nose where you can learn all about handkerchiefs. So she irons the handkerchief because handkerchiefs are small, they're square, they're flat, they don't have ruffles, they don't have lace, they're simple. And you just have to make them flat and then you have to fold them in a proper way and iron that. But unfortunately, it takes her 3 hours to iron something like 34 handkerchiefs. And she calculates handkerchief ironing is paid on a piece rate, that if she were being paid as opposed to, say, I'll work for free, she would have made less than a penny.
Oh, wow.
For her. So if she had to iron for a living, she would starve. But they try her out doing fancy ironing. So she gets this sort of pinafore, which is a type of apron, really, goes over a woman's dress. And they're often fancy and they have lace and ruffles. And she does better at that. But still, by the time they break for a meal, first of all, she's exhausted. And secondly, all the girls who are working there, starting with Janie, are starting to talk about, oh, poor Elizabeth, she's not going to make it in the laundry biz. What other kind of job should she get so she doesn't starve? Because she's not very strong and she doesn't want to be a nurse because she doesn't like patients. And they decide she should get it. There's this confectionery candy shop hiring and she's well-spoken and maybe she should get a job there. So she fails at a laundry, but the whole story is it's pretty entertaining and they're different characters and she writes about it. And she finds that these laundry women are actually really nice for the most part. They're not like the stereotype. And they're actually take a lot of pride in their work, I guess, because if you're no good at it, you get weeded out first. And somebody like Janie, who's paid by the piece, is actually, she really likes her job and she's really good at it. She's really fast and she makes a reasonable amount of money. I mean, not by our standards, but by the standards of the alternative employment, which would be probably for her working as a servant.
Point here is that this is a trade.
It's a trade.
And it's very hard.
Right. It's very hard. And so the reason people are sending their laundry to the commercial laundry, there's a couple of reasons. One is particularly men may be living in places where even if they're wearing detachable collars and cuffs, which is what people did, they can't really wash them. There isn't a good place where they can do their own laundry. And they're men, of course, so they want the women to do their laundry.
Right.
So they send their laundry out. And the similar thing with Elizabeth Banks is living in this boarding house where they send the laundry out. And the other reason is because laundry is such an onerous job. So if you have enough money, but not so much that you have a household staff of servants, by 1900-ish, Elizabeth Banks is writing in 1907, there are these commercial steam-powered laundries that you can send your clothes out and have them laundered for a reasonable price. So there's some capital equipment involved, but a lot of handwork and a lot of labor.
So I realized I was listening to this description of this. There wasn't any bleaching.
Oh, bleaching.
I mean, periodically, when my clothes were very dirty when I was a kid, my mom would have to bleach them.
Right. So bleaching, I don't know whether they were bleaching in commercial laundries. I suspect they were, actually, because particularly whites in this period were very important and very fashionable. The suffragette movement famously dressed in white.
Right.
And now people who want to make a point about women's rights, politicians such will often dress in white. What has gotten lost along the way is that one reason that the suffragettes dressed in white was this labeled them as middle-class, respectable ladies
who could
keep their clothes cleaned and have them properly laundered.
I see. This a little bit like the civil rights people in the 50s.
In the suits. Right.
So interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. But yes, bleach is something that goes way back, at least to the ancient Egyptians. One way to bleach is to take your fabric and alternate an acid and a base. And so what people would do is this would not necessarily be for clothes, but for the raw material.
I see.
For lace collars that you see in Dutch art, this would be the stuff that's made into that. They would take sour milk or buttermilk, and that would be the acid stage, and they would soak it in that, and they would spread it out in the sun.
Oh, really? So you'd have like a big yard of stuff that had been impregnated
with
sour milk.
And then you would rinse it out, and you would have it in something that contained some type of alkaline, like potash, which is literally ash. And you would do the same thing again. And
was it like multiple times?
It's multiple times. And not only was it multiple times, it took multiple months to do.
Basically, as opposed to me pouring my Clorox
in. There was a season for doing bleaching. The process is similar to what you might do in your home with your laundry, but the amount of space and the amount of time might be less. In the 1780s, I believe, there's a French chemist named Berthollet.
Or a famous French chemist.
He's a very famous French chemist. He figures out that you can use chlorine. But chlorine is a poisonous gas.
Yeah.
So you can bleach with chlorine, but you'll die. Horrible death, like in the trenches in World War I. People have to figure out, like, how can we make the chlorine stable and safe? There are various ways of combining it with other elements to make it. And and eventually there is a bleaching powder. And that's what people use all the way into late 19th, when Clorox is the first liquid bleach. But people use this chlorine powder, which is chlorine with other elements added to A, make it solid, and B, make it not kill you.
A desirable thing.
We also were talking about ironing a lot.
Right.
So it's worth talking about the wardrobe of circa 1900.
Right.
Of course, there's a vast difference in society depending on how much money you have. But let's take a kind of person who would be a working middle class person. So not super, super poor, not fresh off the boat from starving in Ireland, not super, super rich, but somebody who had a job as a clerk or as a shop girl or something like that. And they would probably have two or three shirts, one or two outfits, like skirts for women. This was a period where women, particularly working women, wore a lot of what were called shirtwaists. They would wear a blouse and a long skirt. And one advantage of this is that you didn't have to launder the skirt very many times. You did have to keep the blouses looking good.
Right.
So if you were working in a shop, that actually was quite burdensome because those people didn't make much money.
Did they also have undergarments?
And they had undergarments. Yeah. They would have some kind of shift undergarment. And this was still, women would wear corsets in this period, which were undergarments, which include ways of, that wouldn't be right next to your skin. You'd have some sort of chemise under the corset. And a man would have maybe one, maybe two suits, or a suit and a couple of pairs of pants. And this is not, these small wardrobes are, this is not just 1900. I mean, this goes well into the 20th century.
A little bit of a surprise to me because I have this stereotype, which is women with these 27 different layers of undergarments.
The silhouette at the turn of the century is not quite as elaborate.
I see.
So there are layers, and you would be able to wash your undergarments in a sink or a bucket or that sort of thing.
They're not that voluminous.
And that's really important that you can wash those. And the similar thing with men's collars and cuffs. They're detachable. So you can wash them every day, even if necessary, but frequently, and wash the shirts once a week, something like that. So people don't have like tons and tons of clothes. Cleanliness, however, by the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, is very important as in society. Whether you get a job may depend on whether your fingernails are clean. So it's not like if you go back to, I don't know, 1700, it's not like everybody is running around stinking and being grimy. This is a period where, and there are commercial soaps available, Ivory soap.
Yeah.
That's for cleaning your body more, but you can use it to clean laundry. And that is one way it is marketed too.
It's the reason for the cuffs that I'm wearing a jacket.
You're wearing a jacket and we can see your cuffs.
And
the collar is more visible because even if you take off your jacket, you might be wearing a vest.
I see.
And these are those detachable collars that stick up and look very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So this is a period, the wardrobes are pretty small, but cleanliness is next to godliness. It's a period where you are expected to have your clothes clean. And if you are kind of poor, like you're a shop girl, that can be very burdensome, especially if you live, if your living quarters don't allow you to easily wash your clothes and you have to send them out. And it may just cost, say, a dollar, but you're making $3 a week. And so that's kind of a problem.
Okay. So this is the milieu into which
the washing machine
comes in.
The washing machine, the domestic washing machine that runs on electricity, which is important to point, is runs on electricity because previously there were sort of mechanical means of helping you wash your clothes, but they didn't do the whole job and they didn't use electricity. The washing machine is invented by Hurley Company, which is called the Thor.
Mighty Thor.
Mighty Thor.
Right.
And you put the clothes in and you hook it up to the electrical outlet, which by 1908, some people have electrical outlets. It moves the clothes back and forth a few times one way, a few times the other way, sort of agitates them.
Yeah, right.
So that they don't like all end up in one giant clump. Is introduced in 1908.
Is it popular right away?
It is incredibly popular.
Okay.
And one of the places you get it is from the electric company. And the electrical company...
The utilities are selling washing.
They're trying to get people
right.
to want electricity.
Right.
Because electricity has rivals. I mean, you can light your house with coal gas. That's how people lit, or with kerosene lamps. People had lighting in their homes better than candle lighting.
So they're saying, I don't need this.
In fact, I actually found an ad from the Indianapolis Light and Heat Company from 1910. So this is a little bit later. And the ad is basically a comic strip.
Right.
Most of the ad is a comic strip. And the comic strip shows the electricity salesman knocking on the door of a house. And the woman opens the door and he's like, I'm here to tell you why you need electric lights and how your life can be so wonderful with electric light. And she's like, go away. I'm busy doing the laundry. I don't have time to talk. I don't need electric lights and I'm busy. So he sneaks around the house and peers through the window, which is open, of the room where she's actually at the wash tub.
Right.
And she says, and he says, you know, you can now get an electrical washing machine that will do all that work for you. If you install electricity, you know, you could get electric washing machine. It's not just lights.
Right.
And there's a panel where her husband has come home and the sales guy is still there. I don't know if that makes sense, but I guess it was late in the day. The husband comes home from work and she's like, honey, we have to get electricity so we can have this washing machine. And the final panel is the woman sitting in a rocking chair, reading a book, surrounded by electrical gadgets.
Right.
She's got an electric stove, and on the top of the stove is an electric iron. So
right.
no more. It's on the stove. I think that's just for artistic license.
Right.
But the point is, you don't need to heat it on the stove. An electric vacuum cleaner. She's got an electric toaster.
Wow.
And she's got an electric light. There, most prominently, is the Thor washing machine.
Literally the brand Thor.
The brand Thor. It says Thor in big letters, which is one reason it's the most prominent, because all these other ones have tiny little letters telling you what they are.
Right.
But the Thor washing machine.
So the people say, why do you want electricity? It's so you don't have to do laundry.
Laundry. And another example that I found is the Ventura County Power Company, which Ventura County is just north of Los Angeles, in 1909. So remember, this is patented, or this is first put on the market in 1908.
Right.
1909, the Ventura County Power Company is advertising that they're back in stock. We have the Thor washing machines back in stock. And we sold out the last time we had them. You better come quick.
Wow. You know, it sounds comic now, but just think about how much work and toil
right,
and
right.
And there is nobody in the history of humanity who said, oh, good, I'm going to scrub the laundry today.
Right. Right. Well, I don't know. History of humanity is a long time. But yes, it was not.
Okay,
it was a very onerous job.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a journalist in 1912 who writes an article for Good Housekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And the article is basically ragging on men who won't buy washing machines for their wives. Oh, his name is Alan L. Benson. And he says, no man worth his salt would spend a seventh of his time at a tub. And that's a reference to the idea that laundry took one out of seven days. Yeah. Power laundry machinery is not so expensive that people in ordinary circumstances cannot afford to buy it, whereas washing by hand is so hard that no woman should do it. It makes no difference who the woman is, whether she is a housewife or a servant. Washing is too hard for her. In the winter, it invites pneumonia. At all times of the year, it is drudgery. And if bending over a washboard were not a crime against a woman's body, the fact that it is a crime against her right to be happy would
Whoa.
Be enough to condemn it. And this is a man
writing this. Well, this is pretty strong stuff.
Yeah,
it's strong stuff.
So, you know, sentiments, your story about washing on the washboard.
Yeah.
But how about some numbers?
Okay.
And that we actually have some numbers because the Rural Electrification Administration, which was this group of co-ops, rural co-ops that brought electricity to the hinterlands, they did a study right after World War II of farm wives. And they studied before and after washing machines. So this is in 45, 46. And they found for a sort of standard, they had a standard load of laundry. They found that washing it, this is the whole laundry process. This is just the part where you're washing it, took 4 hours with the wash tub. But it took 41 minutes with a washing machine.
Wow.
And they also measured how many steps this farm wife would take to do her laundry. And it was like 3,100 and some odd.
Wow.
Before and a tenth that many after. Essentially, what you have is this enormous reduction in the amount of time it takes to do the laundry because of the electric washing machine. And it becomes very standard. And people who can't afford to have one in their house do what you did in college and what people, many people who live in apartments do now, which is they would go to a coin-operated laundromat and use an electrical washing machine that way, as opposed to, you know, washing the clothes at their wash tub.
Which I can attest is no matter how much of a pain it is better to do that than to try to do it yourself.
Laundry gets better and more effective, not just because of the machines, the mechanical side of the laundry, the agitation of the, but also because of improvements on the chemical side. And you go from soaps to detergents, and detergents are, you know, engineered in a lab to, for maximal effectiveness. I remember when I was a kid, there were these little science lessons on TV that were called commercials, and they would explain what enzymes were.
Right.
And that this new detergent had enzymes, and the enzyme, and enzymes exist all over, not just in detergents, they're in your body.
Right.
But an enzyme is a type of catalyst. And they would say they're like little locks and keys, and an enzyme is a catalyst. A catalyst is something that, through a lock and key kind of mechanism, allows a chemical reaction to take place and then it goes away. You know,
and for me,
One
of the big changes is that that college laundromat was an older laundromat and it only had a hot water cycle, possibly a warm water cycle.
Right.
I was tall and have long arms and wore cotton shirts. And as a result, I spent my entire college career with shirts that had shrunk and were too long. And now you can wash in cold water that doesn't shrink.
So
cotton.
Did you dry your shirts in the dryer?
Oh, yeah, because I was
Well, that's why they shrank.
Yeah.
The hot water alone probably wouldn't have shrunk them if you'd stretched them out. I mean, you
Right, but I did not know anything about this.
I just said
this was my lot in life.
And yes, so washing in cold water is a relatively new phenomenon, and it's enabled by detergents.
Right.
It happened in the U.S. first.
Oh, it did.
My husband has taught a business school case that involves introducing a detergent into Europe. And one aspect of it was convincing the Europeans that they didn't have to boil everything, essentially. They didn't have to only use hot water, that they could use colder waters with this detergent.
Saving on energy costs. And,
right, exactly.
And apparently not saving as much on shrinkage as I had thought until just now.
Right. Another difference between the U.S. and a lot of other places in the developed world is that we use dryers as opposed to use a clothesline. And if you go to Italy, certainly, which is a place I've spent a lot of time, you have a clothesline, or even in London. And so, like, what do they do when it rains? Well, they have these little racks that they use inside. And the other thing Italians in particular are famous for is using all different kinds of fabric softeners and stuff. They add a lot of chemicals to different parts of the laundry cycle to get effects that we often get just by putting in the dryer. So getting it to be softer and not as stiff. You know, if you've ever washed a washcloth or a towel and then hung it out to dry. So it's not just using it for your shower or whatever, but you wash it in the washing machine, it's completely soaked, you hang it out to dry, it becomes very stiff and not soft. And you can get over that with fabric softener, but then it won't dry as well.
Right. We're so, you know, as a society, so pro-dryer that, in fact, there's tons of neighborhood associations that will not let you.
Right. Yes.
And people who are energy efficiency nuts are very furious because 5% or something like that of the household electricity used in the United States is for dryers.
Dryers, yes. Right. Exactly. So in 1900, housework, that is cleaning, laundry, and meals, took about 58 hours a week.
For the,
for a typical American household. And today it's less than 9 hours a week. Now, that's not all laundry, but
the big
laundry is a big component.
This is, and the point is, this is an absolutely fantastic.
It's the best innovation ever.
And, you know, we're saying that jokingly, but the economists who have studied this, Hans Rosling and people like that, are literally saying this is the best liberating technology ever invented.
And there's a famous economics paper called Engines of Liberation, which quotes some of this Rural Electrification Administration statistics and basically makes the point that all these labor-saving household devices made it possible for women to enjoy their right to be happy, but also for women to go out into the commercial workforce and do more productive things.
And so the foundation of things like women being able to do things like podcasts.
Yes. Thank you for joining us for Everyday Abundance. This podcast is sponsored by the Abundance Institute, and you can find all the episodes and show notes on their website at abundance.institute. Very easy to remember. Also easy to remember is our YouTube channel, Everyday-Abundance. Please subscribe. You can also find episodes wherever you get podcasts. Our producer is Toby Murashanu, and the music was written and performed by John Harden.
If you like this and want to support us, the most important thing you can do is actually leave a review. And this matters in ways that the gods of the algorithm are best able to explain.